Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ira Melman. There are reports of this week's California shootings possibly having a connection to Islamic State. U.S. media are reporting that one of the two suspects in the killing of 14 people in California was inspired by the Islamic State militant group. U.S. law enforcement sources told media that Tashfeen Malik, who went on a shooting rampage with her husband, Syed Rizwan Farooq, on Wednesday, pledged allegiance to Islamic State in a Facebook post. The New York Times reports there is no evidence the group directed Malik to carry out the attack. U.S. investigators are said to be studying evidence that Malik, a Pakistani native who had been living in Saudi Arabia when she married Farooq, had pledged allegiance to Islamic State leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. The investigation is focused on the motive behind the attack, which also wounded 21 people during a holiday party at a social services agency in San Bernardino, California. Officials said they don't know what prompted Farooq and Malik to open fire on Farooq's co-workers, but have not ruled anything out. Germany's parliament has voted overwhelmingly to send military aid to fight Islamic State militants in Syria, answering France's appeal for help after last month's deadly Paris attacks. Lawmakers in Berlin voted 445 to 146 Friday to send Tornado reconnaissance jets, a frigate, refueling aircraft, and up to 1,200 military personnel to join the coalition against IS. However, German pilots will not join U.S., British, French, and Russian airstrikes against Islamic State targets in Syria. Following the Paris attacks, French President Hollande appealed to the international community. This is VOA News. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says it may be possible to get Syria's government and rebel forces to cooperate against Islamic State militants even before an agreement is reached on when and how President Bashar al-Assad will relinquish power in his war-torn country. Kerry, who was in Athens Friday, said all sides in the Syrian civil war will only cooperate in fighting to suppress the Islamic State group if they are confident that a mutually acceptable solution about the Syrian leader's future is in sight. Otherwise, Kerry said, it would be extremely difficult to secure such cooperation.
The solution is to end the war. And the best way to deal with this crisis, as we have said again and again, is to make every step possible as fast as possible to bring about a ceasefire, get into the political discussion, and let Syrians decide the future of Syria through that discussion. That's our goal.
Senior State Department officials said Kerry's comments do not represent a shift in U.S. policy. The United States is striking down a key gender barrier, opening all of its military combat positions to women. VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden has more on the historic announcement that could see women playing key combat roles in the fight against Islamic State.
Women have been risking their lives in places like Afghanistan and Iraq for years. Soon, they'll be able to join the fight on any front line.
To succeed in our mission of national defense, we cannot afford to cut ourselves off from half the country's talents and skills. We have to take full advantage of every individual who can meet our standards.
The order issued Thursday by Defense Secretary Ash Carter gives the U.S. military branches 30 days to open all positions to women, including all infantry units and special forces.
Now, more than ever, we cannot afford to have barriers limiting our access to talent.
Defense officials say despite concerns, all key players are now on board, although it could be months before women are ready to jump into the most elite and dangerous jobs. Jeff Selden, VOA News, the Pentagon.
Two men who were denied entry to a nightclub later returned with others and firebombed it early, setting off a blaze that killed all 16 people who were trapped inside by smoke and flames, according to authorities in Cairo, Egypt. Terrorism was quickly ruled out as the cause of the attack at the El Sayed restaurant and club in Cairo's Agusa district. Egypt has been battling a growing Islamic insurgency in recent months. The overnight fire that came on the first day of the weekend in Egypt also injured three other people. I'm Ira Melton in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Joe DiCapua in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Thousands of United Nations soldiers and police are trying to end or at least contain the sectarian conflict in the Central African Republic. To do that, however, they'll need to deal with the country's warring militias, as well as the rumor mill.
That's Chris Stein reporting. Details coming up. We'll also hear from the head of mission for Doctors Without Borders in CAR about the ongoing humanitarian crisis there. Also in the news, German police arrest five men suspected of firebombing migrant shelters, while the Netherlands detains a suspected member of Al-Qaeda. And over 4,500 people flee into the eastern DRC to escape fighting in South Sudan's western Equatoria region. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sonny Young, music from Sierra Leone, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. The Associated Press says prosecutors in Dresden and Zwickau, Germany, have detained five men today who are suspected of throwing firebombs at migrant shelters. They're expected to face charges of attempted murder and attempted arson. The suspects have not been identified. Meanwhile, officials in the Netherlands have arrested an 18-year-old Syrian refugee as a suspected member of the terrorist organization Al-Qaeda. Also today, Belgian police have detained six men for attempting to smuggle migrants from Brussels to London in trucks. Authorities say the smugglers charge more than $1,600 per person and place them in inhumane and dangerous conditions. And the U.S. government has announced $24 million to provide food, water, and shelter for migrants and refugees. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry announced the aid today in Athens, Greece. The aid package will be managed by the UN Refugee Agency. The migrant and refugee exodus from Africa to Europe began last year. Much attention has been paid to the dangerous and often fatal boat journeys across the Mediterranean. But now, refugees from years of war in Syria, Afghanistan, and Iraq have changed the character of Europe's migrant crisis. Courts in many European Union countries have started sending back some of the 200,000 Africans who may not qualify for political asylum. VOA's David Arnold has that story.
The migrant crisis began last year when sub-Saharan Africans began shipping out in rickety boats from the coast of Libya. Smugglers had a brisk business with migrants escaping terrorists, forced and lengthy military conscription, and rampant unemployment. The numbers crossing the Mediterranean from Libya to Italy rose, but suddenly others from Middle Eastern countries began landing on Greek islands. Deputy Director of Amnesty International's Europe and Central Asia office, Gary Vangulik, calls the shift dramatic.
Now, because there are so many Syrians, for example, as part of this group, it's clear that they are refugees, and that sort of changed the discussion. Now, I share a concern that many have, which is that we've forgotten a little bit about that initial group. There are still many refugees coming from sub-Saharan African countries. And what we've seen is sort of a discriminatory approach, if you will, towards sort of favoring Syrian refugees. That's problematic.
Each European country that admits refugees and migrants decides how to handle those who choose to stay. And each country decides who will go home and who might face political persecution. Vangulik fears that some governments are automatically taking Middle East refugees and denying safe harbor to some Africans who face equal peril at home.
What we need to see in each of these countries as people arrive is a fair and full assessment of every individual's claim for asylum. And the big risk that we flag as Amnesty is that we're going to see blanket refusals of people purely because of where they're from. We're very worried that we lose that very basic fundamental principle of international law, which is those who need protection should get it. That seems to be slipping away, and we're deeply concerned that because of this overemphasis on certain nationalities, we're going to risk sending people back to conflict situations and to persecution. And that is a very fundamental violation of their human rights.
Hungary is one of several countries that has decided that Country of origin is the only test necessary. If you entered Hungary from a so-called safe country in the Balkans, you are automatically returned. Africans are not the only victims of this swift justice, Van Gulik says.
Hungary has just changed its laws and has basically declared any person who comes through a safe country be sent back. What that means is they've declared certain countries like Serbia as safe countries, and so anyone traveling through Serbia is automatically sent back. Now, that means 98% of people. And in the Balkans, what we saw is problems, I mean, in Serbia and Macedonia, with people being pushed back. So that means without any checks of their case, just being sent back over the border wherever they came from.
The migrant population of Europe has swollen to almost 1 million in the last 12 months. Countries that have a history of welcoming migrants and refugees are now tightening their borders. Even the most generous governments are making judgments based on nationality, not politics.
People from Syria, for example, we know that they are refugees. I mean, we have there doesn't need to be as strong, as long an asylum process as for some of the others. Germany is assessing everyone individually, but they're also facing a big backlog now. If you think like 800,000 people have to be processed, that takes a lot of time. But the only big problem in Germany is that they have also now adopted the issue of safe countries again. That means that they're going to send everyone who comes from Albania, for example, or Serbia, straight back.
Sweden has been a haven for refugees for years. But as Amnesty International reports this week that Eritreans have a right to international protection, Van Gulik says Sweden is shutting its door.
Sweden has always been at the forefront of hospitality, frankly. They've high number of asylum seekers in the country. They take on really a disproportionate amount of refugees. And sadly, they've now declared that they are not going to take more people. In some sense, understandable, because Europe is paralyzed. Europe is not dividing this responsibility properly.
Even if migrants get their day in a European court, judges will find it difficult to understand the social and political landscape of a migrant's plea. Van Gulik remembers why a judge sent a girl back to Sierra Leone.
A few years ago, I remember following the case of a woman from Sierra Leone, and I found it interesting because I remember the judge asking her, "Were you really raped?" And she said, "Yes." And then the judge asked, "Well, but wouldn't you have told your family about it?" In the end, he ruled that it was not credible because she hadn't told her family. Now, anyone working with survivors of sexual violence can tell you that they don't often tell anyone, let alone male family members.
Many of the estimated 200,000 Africans may not have their day in a European court. Instead, they're likely to be returning home on a plane with a ticket paid for by the country that decides they had no right to stay. This is David Arnold reporting for VOA from Washington, D.C.
More than 4,600 people have fled recent fighting in South Sudan's western Equatoria region. They crossed the border into the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. The fighting is between local groups known as Arrow Boys and the South Sudanese Army. The Arrow Boys began as vigilante groups that formed to fight LRA rebels from Uganda. Their weapons were bows and arrows. The UN Refugee Agency, the UNHCR, says this week it registered over 3,400 South Sudanese in DRC's Dungu territory. Nearly all of them are women and children, and some walked for 3 days to cross the border. The UN agency says most of the men remained in South Sudan. The majority of the South Sudanese refugees are being sheltered by local families. Others have also fled the fighting in western Equatoria region. The UNHCR says more than 1,200 Congolese who have been refugees in South Sudan's Ezo settlement have returned to the DRC. Many others who left Ezo have fled into the bush. Central African Republic is scheduled to hold elections at the end of this month, but a leading African think tank says the country is too dangerous to hold a free and fair vote. The Institute of Security Studies says CAR officials cannot guarantee security or an accurate voter roll. It also says militia groups cannot be disarmed by December 27th. Meanwhile, the recent visit by Pope Francis to Bangui raised hopes the country could move toward peace after years of violence between Muslim rebels and Christian militias. However, the medical aid group Doctors Without Borders says the humanitarian crisis in CAR remains critical. Nearly a 500,000 people are displaced within the country, while another 500,000 are refugees in neighboring countries. Thierry Dumont is head of the mission for the group, also known by the French acronym MSF. From Bangui, he spoke to me about why the crisis continues.
It's a long story. You know, CAR have been in humanitarian trouble, I would say, for many years. And already in 2011, we said that in a report called Asylum Crisis. And then in addition, you had another crisis on top of that in 2012 until now. So that's why CAR is still in big trouble.
What specifically are you seeing at this stage?
You know, we are a humanitarian medical organization. So what we see is people facing difficulties to be treated, to have access to health care. And on our side, sometimes we have difficulties as well to give support to the people who need to get some support.
How widespread are MSF operations in the Central African Republic?
We started working in CAR 20 years ago, and we are having 17 different projects all over the country. We employ 2,300 Central African people, and it's about 240 expatriates, volunteers, working in CAR.
Are you seeing the same problems at all 17 MSF projects?
No, it's different. In the western part, for example, close to the border with Cameroon, it has been very quiet since, I would say, May 2014. We can work normally. We work in health centers outside of the main city there. But in Bangui, it's different. Bangui, I would say, it's up and down. It can be quiet until September 2015. We saw that the situation was improving, and by sudden, we had this violence. And I think we lost a lot at that time.
Do you think Pope Francis's recent visit will have any effect?
Well, at least it had an effect, a very positive effect during 48 hours, I would say. But the night after he left, somebody already was killed in the famous PK5. So I think it's good that he came. But was he able to change everything? I'm not sure of that. You had the situation in Bangui. But then you have the situation in Bambari or in Kagabantoro or in Batangafo, in other parts of the country. And I'm afraid there that they don't really pay so much attention at the visit of the Pope.
What do you think needs to be done to at least ensure that MSF is able to do its work?
To be able to do our work, in fact, we need two things. We need to be able to provide care, but we need the people as well, the patients, to be able to go freely to our places. So it's a two-way situation. It's not only protecting us, it's also protecting the patients. So we need more security, I would say.
How do you feel about the security at your clinics? I know in some other countries, like South Sudan, the clinics are often in danger. What about in CAR?
It's pretty okay. It's pretty okay. We did a lot of communication. Every week we do a round table with a different network, and we do our best to explain people who we are, why we are there, and that we are neutral, and so and so and so. And I was telling you that we are here working for 20 years now. So I think for our visibility as well, it's very important. So I would say that MSF is pretty well accepted, pretty well known. We have a good reputation here in CAR, but you will always have people who don't really care. Last week, we had a car stolen in Bangui, and the week before, another car was stolen from us close to the airport. So the thing is, you have poverty here, extreme poverty. Some people don't really care about others. They care about themselves. They just think about the profit they can get from an organization like MSF. and they steal whatever they can.
Aside from the wounds that you treat because of the violence in the country, what are the major health concerns for Central African Republic?
I would say malaria is coming first. Then we have, of course, HIV, TB programs, maternity as well. And we are mainly focused on kids, you know, below 5 years old. Another major activity is vaccination, because vaccination coverage in CAR is pretty low, and mainly because of the security condition for the last 3 years.
In other news for the CAR, thousands of UN soldiers and police are trying to end or at least contain the sectarian conflict. However, to do that, they must not only deal with the country's warring militias, but the rumor mill as well. Chris Stein reports from the capital, Bangui.
Guillermo Bokomo is a charity worker who lives in Bangui's Fatima neighborhood. Fatima has been the scene of clashes between Muslim and Christian militias, including an attack on a church last year that killed at least 17 people. Soldiers from Burundi are stationed in the neighborhood as part of the United Nations peacekeeping mission, but Bokomo says they haven't been able to stop fighting from breaking out in Fatima. He's even heard rumors that the Burundian peacekeepers transport fighters from the nearby Muslim neighborhood to carry out attacks. If a rumor is repeated over and over, and it's the same rumor, then there must be some truth to it, he says. It's not uncommon to hear such rumors about the UN peacekeeping mission, known as MINUSCA. Launched in September 2014, more than 11,000 police and soldiers are deployed across the country, trying to contain the violence. Luis Carrillo, the commissioner of the UN police force in the country, wouldn't address the topic of rumors directly, but said MINUSCA is committed to keeping the country safe.
There are always events that it's impossible to prevent, even if you have one police officer in each house or in each street. It's the community that needs to be balanced.
Clashes, however, continue. More than 100 people have been killed around one Bangui neighborhood since September, Human Rights Watch reported last month. The heads of the Central African Regional Bloc in November called for more troops for the mission. Meanwhile, several people have accused MINUSCA troops of sexual abuse. French troops stationed in the country have faced similar allegations. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon fired MINUSCA's head after the claims came to light earlier this year. Ilaria Alagrozi, the Central African researcher for Amnesty International, says MINUSCA must do a better job of explaining its mandate if it wants to win over residents like Bokomo.
Address these perception problems will be very important and can be done, for example, by conducting regular surveys among the affected communities and to make sure that, you know, perception expectations of the people inform also the protection strategies of the mission.
UN peacekeepers scored a major success during the recent visit to Bangui of Pope Francis. No major security incidents were reported during his trip. Their next challenge will be to keep people safe during the constitutional referendum planned for December 13th. Chris Stein for VOA News, Bangui.
Chinese President Xi Jinping is offering African nations $60 billion in loans, foreign aid, and debt forgiveness over 3 years. The figure is double the development package announced last year for Africa. The Chinese leader made that announcement today at the Forum on China-Africa Cooperation Summit in Johannesburg. A week-long international conference that focused on AIDS and sexually transmitted diseases in Africa has ended in Zimbabwe's capital, Harare. Delegates at ICASA 2015 discussed a reported shortage of antiretroviral drugs to treat HIV/AIDS and a lack of government funding for health care. Sebastian Mofu reports from Harare.
Medical researchers, HIV activists, and health officials from across the continent met at the conference known as ICASA to look for ways to achieve an AIDS-free Africa. The United Nations says there have been dramatic strides in the fight against HIV/AIDS, and the World Body says ending the epidemic by 2030 is a realistic prospect. Zimbabwe's Health Minister David Parirenyatwa says immediate treatment for anyone diagnosed with HIV is one of the main steps towards that goal.
So the curtain has indeed come down on ICASA 2015, and it is time to move forward and to implement the resolutions that have been enunciated here. Test and treat, that has come out very strongly. So once they are tested for HIV and they are found to be positive, go straight for treatment. Are we going to afford it as Africa? This is where the international community comes in. This is where mobilization of resources comes in.
Earlier this week, medical aid group Doctors Without Borders released a report saying Africa is facing shortages of antiretroviral drugs, or ARVs. The shortages are likely to get worse with the new World Health Organization, WHO, guidelines. The guidelines remove all limits on eligibility for antiretroviral therapy among people with HIV. If one tests positive, should get treatment. The U.S. Global AIDS Coordinator Ambassador Deborah Bex was one of the delegates at the ICASA conference. She said the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR, has released additional funding to some African countries to help them abide by the new guidelines. She said some countries were managing on their own without much funding.
We have been very encouraged. If you look over the last decade and you see what South Africa is doing to invest in the pandemic, when you look at what Namibia is doing to invest in the pandemic, when you look at what Botswana has always done. So there's countries on the continent that have the resources that are clearly applying those resources to control the epidemic in their countries. We think that more and more countries need to make that kind of investment.
African countries are signatories to the 2001 Abuja Declaration, which stipulates that 15% of each nation's budget should be allocated to health expenditures. But many countries have failed to live up to that pledge, including Zimbabwe, where most of the budget is spent on defense, civil servants, wages, and travels for senior government officials. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Joe DiCapua in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on the Voice of America.
One of the world's great cities, the gateway to America for generations. VOA brings you New York in 12 rarely seen views, presenting the 2016 VOA calendar, a gift from us, free for the asking. Just send us your mailing address in an email to calendar@voanews.com, and you can have New York's beauty grace your wall all next year.
With your ears on Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best Pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC. Every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists, too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best right here on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Over 4,600 people flee fighting in South Sudan's western Equatoria region for the DRC. Amnesty International says Africans may lose out to Syrians in a bid to get European political asylum. And Doctors Without Borders says the humanitarian crisis in the Central African Republic remains at critical levels. Coming up, music from Sierra Leone and in our feature segment, South Sudanese Heroes in Australia. I'm Joe DiCapua. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports is next. Well, I don't get a chance to do this very often anymore, right? Time now for the sunny side of sports with Sonny Young. Hello, Sonny.
Hello, Joe. Great to have you back in the studio.
It's nice to be back in the saddle here.
Well, Joe, we're going to talk about the Big Apple, New York City. It's known as one of the big melting pots here in the United States. People from all over the world live in New York, attracted to its vibrant arts, entertainment, business, and yes, sports scenes. One men's college basketball team in New York symbolizes the city's multicultural nature. Brooklyn's Long Island University, known as LIU, has players from Iceland, the Netherlands, Nigeria, Senegal, and Central African Republic. VOA's Bernard Schussman joins us now from New York with this feature on the team.
The team is the Blackbirds. They play in the Northeast Conference that has 21 foreign-born players, five of them at LIU. 20-year-old Nura Zana is from Nigeria. His goal is to play in the National Basketball Association, the top basketball league in the world. But Zana knows there's more to basketball than playing the game.
Hopefully, you know, if I can get a job in the NBA, like an international department job, so, you know, we can help basketball more global, you know, in Africa, and promote the game more in Africa, and, you know, help more kids.
One of his teammates is Glenn Fidanga. This 21-year-old college junior is from the Central African Republic.
Like a lot of kids in Africa, they're dreaming to come here, but they're not lucky enough to get a chance to come. But I was one of the lucky ones to get a chance to come to the United States.
One of the youngest players on the team is 18-year-old Ganlandu Cisse. He's from Senegal. His goal is to play professionally in Europe. Cisse is learning to be independent.
Like college is a lot of different new thing. Like you have to manage your time, your school, your work, basketball court. I mean, it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work. So I'm handling it right now.
Get your head home run first.
Jack Perry has been LIU's head coach for 4 years. He believes strongly in gathering information about possible basketball recruits, no matter where they're from.
And obviously, you want to get a kid that's athletic, that has potential on the basketball court. But we also look at other things, how they handle adversity. Are they constantly whining and complaining or making excuses, that kind of stuff on the court? How do they handle situations with their parents, teachers and things like that?
3 out of the last 5 years, the Blackbirds have been champions of their conference. Perry believes his international team is on track to achieve some of the same glory that LIU has enjoyed in its past basketball history.
He's going to fire it now for three. Good!
Bernard Schussman, VOA News, Brooklyn, New York.
Here at the Wellness Center.
Yeah, I'm out at Brooklyn. Now I'm down in Tribeca, right next to the Narrow. But I'll be hood forever. I'm the new Sinatra. And since I made it here, I can make it anywhere. Yeah, they love me everywhere. I used to cop in Harlem. All of my Dominicanos right there up on Broadway. Pulled me back to that McDonald's. Took it to my stash spot, 560 State Street. Catch me in the kitchen like a Simmons whipping pastry. Cruising down A Street, off-white Lexus. Driving so slow, but BK is from Texas. Me, I'm out that Bed-Stuy, home of that boy boy Biggie. Now I live on Billboard, and I brought my boys with me. Say what up to Tata, still sipping my ties. Sitting courtside, Knicks and Nets give me high five. I be spiked out, I could trip a referee. Tell by my attitude that I most definitely from.
Jay-Z rapped about sitting courtside for the Knicks and the Nets. Those are the two NBA clubs in New York City. The Knicks feature a big Latvian player, 2.21 meters tall, Kristaps Porzingis, who is one of the most talked about big men in the league this season. The 20-year-old Porzingis has been very impressive in his first NBA season. He's averaging about 14 points and 9 rebounds a game. Porzingis was named the Eastern Conference's Rookie of the Month for November. Minnesota Timberwolves center Karl Anthony Towns was named the NBA's Western Conference Rookie of the Month. In NBA action Thursday night, the Miami Heat edged the visiting Oklahoma City Thunder 97-95. It was a wild back-and-forth game that featured 38 lead changes and 11 ties. Miami's star guard Dwayne Wade scored 28 points, including two free throws with less than 2 seconds left in the game to put the Heat ahead to stay. Russell Westbrook and Kevin Durant each scored 25 points for Oklahoma City, which misfired on a pair of three-point shots in the final 10 seconds. In other NBA results Thursday, the Orlando Magic defeated the Utah Jazz 103-94. The San Antonio Spurs beat the Memphis Grizzlies 103-83. The Portland Trail Blazers topped the Indiana Pacers 123-111. The Boston Celtics beat the Sacramento Kings 114-97. And the Denver Nuggets edged the host Toronto Raptors 106-105. Now the Raptors will be at home again on Saturday when they try to stop the record-winning streak of the defending NBA champion Golden State Warriors. Led by sharpshooting guard Stephen Curry, the league's reigning most valuable player, the Warriors have won their first 20 games, the best ever start in NBA history.
They're playing back.
Hey, mates, remember me? This is the old sports emperor with a red-hot listening tip. That's right, give a listen to my pal, the bright and lively sunny man on the sunny side of sports, right here on the Voice of America.
Thanks for that red-hot listening tip, Barry. Our loyal and longtime Voice of America listeners will sometimes ask me, Sonny, what is Barry up to these days? Well, he's enjoying retirement in the southern U.S. state of Georgia. Football news now on the VOA. The alleged corruption at football's world governing body, FIFA, plunged to new depths this week when U.S. authorities charged more than a dozen officials with embezzling money from the organization. Two FIFA vice presidents were arrested in Switzerland, even as the body's executive committee met to discuss key reforms. Henry Ridgewell joins us now with a report from London.
This week was meant to mark a new chapter for FIFA. A key vote was approved on reforms designed to turn it into a trusted and professional sports organisation. Instead, the scale of that task was made clear as 16 FIFA officials were charged Thursday by US authorities who alleged that huge sums were siphoned off, intended to help natural disaster relief and grassroots football programmes and lucrative media rights sold off for bribes. The charges target several of the most senior football executives in South and Central America. U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch said huge sums were involved.
The scale of corruption alleged herein is unconscionable. And the message from this announcement should be clear to every culpable individual who remains in the shadows, hoping to evade this ongoing investigation. You will not wait us out, and you will not escape our focus.
The U.S. charges came hours after the arrest of two FIFA vice presidents by Swiss police. The allegations lay bare the hypocrisy at the heart of FIFA, says sports historian Philip Barker, who spoke to VOA via Skype.
It's the kind of coaching facilities that they're setting up, the coaching expertise that they're sending in, it all does come across rather empty when it turns out that people are actually enriching themselves from the funds that are supposed to be helping football at the grassroots. It's very disturbing.
11 current and former members of FIFA's executive committee have been charged in the US investigation. The acting president of FIFA, Issa Hayatou, pledged full cooperation.
Les événements qui se sont déroulés ce matin.
Hayatou said that the arrests underscore the necessity to establish a complete program of reforms for FIFA. Those reforms include reducing the power of FIFA's executive committee and greater transparency. The body is due to elect a new president in February, but the criminal investigations could engulf that process, says Barker.
This is one of the big problems with the FIFA investigations, that those who were perceived as being the new broom that might help to clean out the house have also been subject to allegations.
Meanwhile, former President Sepp Blatter is suspended as part of a separate investigation by Swiss authorities into a $2 million payment to European soccer head Michel Platini. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Thanks, Henry. Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny, and my Twitter handle is @VOA Sunny Sports. Joining me once again, Joe DiCapua. Joe, we heard from Bernard Schussman at the top with that multicultural basketball team in New York. You got some ties to New York, don't you?
He was in Brooklyn, so I want to give a shout out to Brooklyn's neighbor, Queens, and my home neighborhood of Maspeth.
Okay.
So I'm sure they're listening. And I want to ask you a question about FIFA. You think it'll ever stand for Former Influential Football Association?
That acronym might fit it a little better, Joe. Anyways, yeah, that's all for now. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Joe DiCapua.
Why, thank you, Sonny. You can listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And, of course, on Fridays, today, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 17 hours UTC right here in the VOA. I'm Joe DiCapua in Washington. Well, time now for a little music. And in tonight's music segment, we feature Sierra Leone's Refugee All-Stars with Work It Brighter.
The street them flow around them cannot notice. Shepherd is calling all his flock. Ready to shiver the air from the grave. To rebuild the walls of Zion. Walls of Zion. Mystic them flow around them cannot notice. Shepherd is calling all his flock, ready to shiver the air from the grave, only to reveal the walls of Zion, walls of with men's wars and our evil.
can see the paradise. Only to reveal the world of Zion. Words of Zion. With only peace and love and fairness, he only walk it right down. Take it or leave it now.
Peace and love and fairness, he only walk it right down.
Promises you have made.
Please try to fulfill them.
No matter what the constraint, just put your people interest first. No matter what the constraint, just put your country interest first. Then you walk it brighter.
Walk it brighter. Walk it brighter, just brighter than the former, and brighter for our future. You walk it brighter. You walk it brighter. You walk it brighter.
That was Sierra Leone's Refugee All-Stars with Work It Brighter. Well, in Canberra, Australia, two South Sudanese-born residents are being called heroes after they disarmed a man who was waving a machete at innocent bystanders. Several people were injured in that incident. Ayen Bior has the story.
John Majura Kwok and Gutch Kot say it was a very normal Thursday night on November 12th when the two were headed home after watching a professional soccer match in Canberra. They hailed a taxi and both jumped into the back seat. Majura Kwok was sitting behind the driver and Kot was on the passenger side. They say they were traveling in moderate traffic when suddenly the taxi driver slammed on his brakes. Both say a man wielding a machete jumped right in front of their taxi. He then jumped over to the passenger side and began attacking the cab driver with the machete. Kot said that's when he knew he had to do something.
I just jumped out quickly, and at the time I assessed the whole street quickly because I'm very familiar with that area. All I could see was just a lot of vulnerable people on the street, children and their families, you know, walking out.
Majura Kwok says the cab driver's screams were deafening.
The taxi driver was just crying out, "Help, help, he stuffed me." So I jumped out from the other side and Gotch jumped out from behind. And because he was on the other side, he was the first person to get there.
While Majura Kwok was helping the taxi driver, Kot says he knew that more lives would be in danger unless they apprehended the suspect.
Survival instinct just kicked in. I was like, whoever gets to the knife first gets to live. And I managed to get to the knife first and just pushed it away and just turned him on his back and used my body to restrain him.
Majura Kwok says being in life-threatening situations is not new to him. He became a refugee as a young boy and had to leave his homeland during Sudan's Second Civil War. He eventually moved to Kakuma refugee camp. He says growing up there taught him he had to toughen up if he was going to survive.
So, you know, when I used to live there, things like this, you know, the incident that I was involved, you know, used to happen, and you just had to depend yourself and sometimes depend other people from being hurt by other people or being harmed by other people.
Majura Kwok does not consider himself a hero. He says he's just one human being helping other human beings. He says he's just glad he could help. Kut agrees.
I don't see myself as an heroic figure or some sort of like an important person. I just think that, you know, the way I was brought up with ethics, you should do the right thing when you're required.
Majura Kwok says the suspect appeared to be mentally unstable. Court documents showed the suspect stated he had no recollection of the attack. He was charged with possessing a dangerous weapon with the intent of using the weapon against others. He was also charged with intentionally wounding and damaging property. The suspect is due to appear in court in 5 months. For VOA News, I'm Ian Bior in Washington.
Nigeria's prolific film industry, Nollywood, churns out more than 3,000 movies every year. But despite that, the 30-year-old movie industry has problems making a profit, all because of piracy. VOA's Paul Ndio has the story.
Nollywood is a $5 billion industry. Film producer Sam Boye is on the set taking his actors through their paces before shooting begins on his latest production, a soap opera about family feuds. Boye has been involved in Nollywood films for nearly 30 years. He says rampant piracy is the main reason film producers are barely making any money.
A producer was in China. He was in China and he said he saw our movie on, they call it 20 in one, that you have 20 movies in one DVD. In China, that is, it's been dubbed into Chinese language without the consent of the producers.
Nollywood is best known for the quantity of film it produces, but not quality. But there are those who are trying to change things. Producer-director Kunle Afoloyana is the filmmaker behind October 1st. Nollywood's film is set in 1960. Against the backdrop of Nigeria's independence from Britain, the movie tells the story of a detective who is dispatched by the British colonial masters to a remote town in the western region of Nigeria to solve a series of murders that caused outrage in the community. With three films under his belt, Afoloyan has earned a reputation in Nollywood for producing quality movies.
It's a nightmare, it's a universal problem, but the way it's being done here, it's alarming. You know, when your film gets pirated and people flashes it in your face and nobody is doing anything, and when you even complain, they want to beat you up, like there's no law in the land. All my film has been pirated, but the most painful one is October 1, which has not even been released on DVD.
Every week in Lagos alone, millions of pirated Nollywood and Bollywood movies compete for customers against the original product. The pirated copies are sold everywhere on sidewalks, street corners, under bridges, and even on top of wheelbarrows for about $1. Nigeria's Copyright Commission says the government is doing all it can to combat piracy. Afam Ezekudu is the Director General of the Copyright Commission.
The proactive enforcement and prosecution activities of the Commission over the last 4.5 years, we have actually reduced the rate of piracy. We are not boasting of trying to eliminate or eradicate piracy in this society, but we have done a lot in terms of trying to limit the impact of piracy.
Still, industry analysts like economist David Omidrian believe Nollywood could be much more profitable and grow even further to boost the oil-producing economy.
The industry is growing about 13% per annum, so we could expect the industry to grow by instantaneously maybe 40% and then consistently for at least the next 4 or 5 years.
Since its inception nearly 20 years ago, the Nigerian movie industry has remained one of the largest employers in the country. And analysts say the industry earns the third highest revenues in the world after Hollywood and Bollywood. Paul Ndiho, VOA News.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next is our VOA editorial. I'm Joe DiCapua in Washington. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Werkinger, and our engineer, Zubair Taeb, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The recent terrorist attacks across the globe are a reminder that the threat of terrorism has not receded. It has reconstituted and remains grave. The U.S. is committed to using force to protect its citizens and allies and is intensifying the campaign to degrade and ultimately defeat ISIL with new strikes against their leaders, oil fields, and territory. At the same time, said Undersecretary for Civilian Security, Democracy, and Human Rights, Sarah Sewell, we must remember that no number of airstrikes, soldiers, or spies can eliminate the complex motives and hateful ideologies that feed terrorism. That is why the U.S. is embracing a broader and more holistic approach to this threat called Countering Violent Extremism, or CVE. CVE calls for addressing the underlying factors that make communities vulnerable to the siren call of violent extremism. It also calls for pushing back against the ideology and propaganda violent extremists wield to lure people to their cause. These factors are complex, contextual, and often only apparent at the community level. As such, they are often beyond the means of national governments alone to address. CVE therefore calls for a much broader set of actors to address these factors through whole-of-society approaches that include local officials, businesses, religious leaders, researchers, women, youth, and even former members of extremist groups. Through this more preventative and holistic approach, CVE seeks to tighten the flow of recruits to the current generation of violent extremist groups while better preventing the next generation of threat. Countering violent extremism is therefore an essential complement to military efforts to defeat the Islamic State. This is not a question of either or, said Undersecretary of State Sewell. This complex and generational threat requires both.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
When news breaks, VOA News is there.
Around the clock, listen to VOA Newscast at the top of each hour, along with our detailed news programs and analysis.
We are online at voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.